now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is David Wargon. David is a universal worker who has come to grips with the fact that he's had alien encounters, and he's had to learn over time how to assimilate these experiences into his everyday three-dimensional existence. He's learned a lot of things along the way. David and I have been in comms for 2-3 years now. I really regard him highly as far as a witness is concerned, as far as having an innate understanding of what the alien encounter experience is all about. So without any further ado, David Wargon, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you today?
I'm fine, David. This is a show I've really been looking forward to. For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell us a bit about how this journey started for you? Like, where were you along your journey when you came to a realization that you were having experiences, whether you really understood the true nature of them or not at the time? Just what was going through your mind, and how did you deal with it and moving forward up to the present day?
Well, I've had paranormal experiences all throughout my life ever since I was a young child. The alien experiences really started when after I became awakened, which was probably roughly around 2004. I went through the spiritual journey. I felt my crown chakra and third eye opening, which was highly unexplainable, but it happened, and it was a magical journey, I have to say. But then since then, that's when I started seeing alien crafts, and I was always in the right place at the right time. Some people claim they've never seen an UFO, and I've seen roughly about 12 to 15 of them throughout 2003 up to present day. And that was just with my eyes alone. That's not with any type of spiritual out-of-body experience or even a dreamlike state, you know, or an abduction. But up till then, I've had numerous accounts. I've written most of it down as best I could. I tried to decipher as best I could. I've even had anywhere from alien implants I felt that were I actually traced with EMF detectors, and I even had experiences to where they were even being removed from me. So the best evidence I can really say is I have a few marks on my body, but it's basically what I experienced.
How was your childhood experiences? Do you remember much of them? Do you remember these experiences in the form of dreams, or did you have any missing time or bleeding nose episodes or anything along those lines?
I used to have a fear when I was a child that there was two people living under my bed. You know, everyone always had that fear of a monster under the bed, but I always kept them at bay. And one night, I do remember clearly, that was my first out-of-body experience. It was like the two men took me from my body. I remember trying to scream for my parents and grabbing onto the walls and being taken out to my backyard where I was left there in the middle of the night. And, you know, that's about as clear as I remember. But, you know, I have had other experiences such as orbs that were banging on windows loud enough for people to hear. My dog and I were the only ones who could see it, and my mom was looking curiously at what that was. I used to remember sitting and playing Legos in the living room and remember seeing spacemen coming through the door. You know, they were not able to interact with me. They said they were just passing through, and I would just ignore it. But my mother would tell me that I had a smorgasbord of imaginary friends, as she would call it, and some of the names I would mention were names of past deceased friends of neighbors, that they were very curious as to how I knew their names. ever since then, once puberty hit, things kind of nulled out, you know, normally, until I hit about 18, and then that's when they started up again. I started seeing more hauntings, more cold spots, more apparitions coming around. But it wasn't until I moved down to Georgia from New Jersey, that's when it really started up for me.
Really? About what age was that?
In my early 20s, I would say. Maybe between 23 to 25. That's when the awakening really began. I'll never forget the very first day. I was sitting at a hair cuttery, and I just happened to look up in the light, and I saw sparkles of light right above me. And ever since that moment, that's when everything started. So it was just one of those things where it felt like it was meant to be.
And how did this process unfold? Did you start to see craft, and did you move from place to place, or did you stay in one spot in Georgia for a while and all this stuff started to happen?
No, it seemed like it mattered where I moved. The very first alien craft I've ever witnessed was in Destin, Florida. I love to take night walks on the beach, usually real late at night. But one night in particular, I was sitting on the beach in Destin, Florida. The high winds, probably about 20 miles per hour coming in off the sea. No clouds in the sky except for very small transparent ones. Until I saw one small hovering, very loud sounding cloud coming in from the distance very slowly. Made it all the way to the sandbar after a certain period of time, turned on a light, beamed straight into the water. I freaked out a little bit and ran off to the pier a little bit, off to the dock. And then I ran back, and I was very curious about it, so I managed to stand right underneath it while it passed over me. And then ever since that moment, they seemed to have followed me no matter where I went. Four different places, you know, where I've moved from different apartments to when I bought my house.
Those things have happened to me and others, too. It's almost like when you move to a new place, they show up after a while just to let you know they haven't forgotten about you, you know?
Yes. Sometimes I would even get frustrated. I do remember I would say, I would look up and say, you know, there'd be a long period of time where I wouldn't see him, so I would just throw my arms up in the air and say, you know what, I'm done with this, I'm out. And then literally the next day they would show right back up again. Okay. This is to say, don't forget about us, you know, we're still here.
Yeah, and it also it's indicative of the fact that they can hear our thoughts and hear our you know, our verbalizations, right? When we like exclaim something like that to the sky, they respond almost immediately.
Correct. There was one experience, though, as well, I'll never forget. It was a Halloween night, and we were having a small get-together, and I noticed it was about 11:30 at night, and my wife asked me to put a strobe light out in the backyard, so I said, okay. So I walked out there, and I looked up and above my tree line, and there was a triangular-shaped craft with an orange running light hovering over top of my pine trees. And I managed to get my wife and her friend down off the deck and witness it, so I knew I wasn't crazy. So it managed to, after I saw it, it took off very fast with no noise at all, and it was so low that you could throw a tennis ball at it if you wanted to. After that experience the next night, I experienced the most unusual thing. It was the feeling I was being pulled out of my bed, but it was in between the dream state and the waking state. And it was strange because my legs went up straight. And if I've ever had an out-of-body experience, it was normally always head first. So I was a little scared. So I said I didn't want to go. So they laid me back down. And the next night, the same exact event happened, which for me is kind of strange because the same event never happened twice. And the same thing happened. I raised up in the air, and I said, no, I don't want to go. So they laid me back down, and I woke up, and I said, if this happens again, I'm going to go. I'm going to see where it takes me. So the next night happened, nothing happened. It was a nice, quiet night. But then the night after, the same thing happened again for the third time, and I let go. I just said, let's see what happens. So I drifted up to the sky, into my bedroom, up to the ceiling, and then got lowered down, hovering off the floor, probably about 2 inches off the floor. Very relaxed state. I had no control of myself other than peacefulness. And I found myself drifting into my dining room, but I had this blur image bouncing left and right, left and right. So I reached my hand out to grab at it, and when I caught it, it was this light blue, very thin arm wearing a crimson and gold robe. I let go because I got startled, and I woke up that night, and I had the horrible stench of sulfur on my right hand for 3 solid days.
Wow.
I could not get rid of it, and it wasn't until a year later that I realized that people who have had encounters with alien greys have had the same experience of sulfur smell, and that was a big shock.
Wow. So you felt that they were lifting you up astrally or physically during those times?
I think it was a physical, but it was like my mind was in a dream set.
Yeah.
It was almost like I was meant to think that it wasn't real. Almost like being drugged, I would say. You know, like anesthesia almost. But I never knew exactly what went on at that moment. But after that experience is when the reptilian experiences started up and the MyLab experiences started. I started experiencing training exercises. I remember one to where I was in a military battlefield having to shoot some weird aliens on the ground, and then there was one to where I was in a water tank and doing some sort of training exercise. Then there was a few other ones to where I was having experiences with reptilians where they were extracting what I felt was my soul, which I know that sounds funny, but there was this most gorgeous ball of light. I remember being tossed around and thrown around very brutally to where I almost didn't want to go to sleep anymore. It was so scary. But I do remember being put into this chair, strapped down, and had my ankles and wrists strapped down, and this machine with three pointy needles were facing at me and extracted this beautiful glowing ball of sparkling light, and it was taken from me, and I was left there unbuckled to fend for myself. But I was able to find a shrapnel of it that fell to the ground, and I was able to hold on to it and put it back in me. I can never describe exactly what it could look like, other than how I'd say it looked like a lava lamp with this gorgeous sparkling of white light. I mean, it was very, very difficult to explain.
Now, when that happened and the device extracted this from you, what part of it did it come from? A particular part of your anatomy, this orb?
I don't really recall what it came out of, but I do remember it went into a cylinder of some sort. It was like a longer cylinder, and they kept it in there. And the shard that fell out was kind of like excess almost. But when I put it back in me, you know, it felt like I changed a little bit. It felt like I was a different person almost. Not so much sympathetic and a little bit more on the aggressive side. I was finding myself kind of, you know, not really picking fights, but just being a lot more aggressive than I have been in the past. And there was one point where I had a neighbor who was a, you know, drug dealer, and he was pestering me while I was walking my dog, you know, and nighttime, and trying to run me over with his motorcycle. And I got irritated. And all I can remember seeing is green and like a reptilian face come towards me as I was about to attack him. And I realized, I came to my senses. I was like, you know, I could hurt this guy, but I don't really want to. That's not who I am. So I just, you know, I kind of looked into it and tried to just find a new way, a new path, and kind of, you know, meditated about it just to get rid of it, because it was not who I was.
So you found yourself at times becoming a bit more impulsive?
Yes. A bit more impulsive and a bit more aggressive, almost like I was a different person almost.
What were your thought processes during this time? Would you catch yourself having thoughts that were, pardon the pun, alien to your normal way of thinking, or different from what you normally thought as?
Kind of like it would be if I were in I was in the military for just a month and a half, but I had that same sensation all over again, like attack, you know, kill, that kind of feeling, you know. Full rage, you know, and like the purest anger you could ever feel, more than just being upset at one person, but more or less, you know, you wanted to absolutely destroy that person, and I didn't want to do that. I said that was not who I am. So I backed out and just went, you know, and just went in my house and just relaxed and thought myself through and got it cleared up, you know. But it was a very scary moment in my life with that one. I realized that's not, you know, normal. And ever since then, I would still get occasional experiences with them being aggressive towards me. I remember one where I felt like one of them was about 8 feet tall, grabbed me by the throat and raising me all the way up in the air, and I was gasping for air. Very strange experiences.
The reptilian. Correct. Was doing that.
Correct. Yeah. But then.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go
ahead. But then I got a weird experience one night. It was, I felt like I was going to have a heart attack. I was, you know, a little, really out of shape. I got really bad sweats. My left arm was getting numb. I felt chest pains almost. And I didn't know what was going on. So I decided to go ahead and just lay down and just, you know, sleep it off. And the next night, the same thing happened. And I was getting really concerned because I was scared. But then that night, something happened. I got a visitation. I remember being in an operating room with bright lights. And the next morning when I woke up, I couldn't move. My whole body was paralyzed. I felt like someone was inside of my chest moving things around. Like my muscles felt wrong. I looked at my chest and I had two burn marks, little round burn marks on one of the ventricles on my heart. And something was behind my left eye. It was like very irritated. And so I decided, when I finally could be able to move, I felt perfectly fine. So I took my EMF tracker, you know, to test the high pulse energy, and I put it up to my heart, and the needle spiked. It was all the way spiked. I put it up to my eye, and the same thing happened, and I did that 3 times. And then I kept seeing this red light in my eye, almost like a camera was on. And it was weird because I could not explain how in the world that was there. And it would turn off and on constantly, but it always felt like there was something behind my eyeball. My ears, the skin on behind my ears would start to fall off a little bit. But then the weird part was that every time I wanted to eat something bad for you, say like fried chicken or something, this thing in my heart would trigger. And it would change my mind and go eat a salad or some fruit. And then the pain would go away. So that happened for a good 2 years, and I lost a lot of weight and started getting healthy. So I'm not really sure. That's why I really believe that there are two types. There really are good ones and bad ones out there, because there was someone looking out for me at that moment. But then the implants started acting funny. I was hearing conversations from random people all over the world. Like if I'd be falling asleep on the sofa, I would hear things like a father and a son talking about their day, a mother and daughter talking about their day, you know, random people, random conversations, and never made any sense to me. And then my right ear would just keep, you know, I'd hear high-pitched sounds coming from it. It would have weird reactions to cell phones. And then it just kept getting worse, where my eye kept getting worse, my ear kept getting worse. And then I got another visitation by these strange creatures. I was sitting in my bedroom, and this was I had full control of my body, full control. And I look over to the left side of my room, and I see two reptilians standing there in the corner, and I'm kind of frozen, and they walk right past me. And then I call out to them and say, "Hey, I got questions here. I need you to come back." Then all of a sudden this kind of a blob creature comes out of my closet and sits down next to me, and he looks at me, and I'm not afraid of him at all. And he says, "Don't worry." He says, "I'm the enforcer." He says, "I'm here for your protection and their protection." And I look over at the closet, and there's two other figures that kind of look like, at first they look like dogs, like dog creatures, but then they manifested in front of me into people. But they were the funniest things I've ever seen. Like they reminded me of two drunk college guys. I have no idea who they were or what they were, but they manifested in front of me, except for their eyes were very white, and they were goofing around, laughing, having jokes, and they were shaking my hand, and they said, "We know what question you're going to answer, or you're going to ask him, and the answer is there are two different types, and we are here for your benefit." And I felt very calm at that point. So they said, "Can we look into your throat, if you don't mind?" And I said, "Sure." So I remember they took out this really bright white light, like a flashlight, and shined it in my eyes, and I passed out. And the next night, I actually witnessed things being extracted from my throat and my ear. It was almost like, looked like little radio devices being taken out of me. And since then, I haven't had any more problems.
As far as hearing the voices and, you know, the conversations and whatnot?
Correct. Yeah, those have stopped. My right ear still itches, though, and still is very irritated, and I still hear things. So I know they must have maybe fixed something, but behind my left eye, it's gone. I haven't had a single red light in there. The one in my chest, I haven't had any pains. I can eat whatever I want, you know, and I still regulate my body weight very well. But it was just very fascinating. But then they sent me this message after they extracted it saying, "We have to go away to an asteroid to do some mining, but don't worry, we'll be back." But they wrote it in a weird language, but I could see it as captions, and I wrote it down immediately after that because I definitely wanted to keep that message.
So they were doing like mining somewhere, perhaps in the solar system, perhaps elsewhere, but that's what they told you anyway. They're going to be away for a while.
Correct. I didn't feel that they were like malevolent. I felt like maybe they were just, you know, the guys they had a call to come help out, you know, that kind of feeling. But it was definitely an interesting experience, and definitely made me feel that there are some good ones watching us, you know.
Absolutely, there are. Now, you mentioned something prior to us coming on, which I thought was fascinating, and you alluded to it briefly earlier, where you talked about the experience where you were placed underwater and you had like a mouth airpiece or something put to your mouth, and then it was an interesting aftermath about that. Do you want to go into that story?
Yeah, like I said before, my eyes are extremely sensitive. They always have been as a child. Like, I could never open them up underwater. It would take up to 40 minutes just to put an eye drop in each eyeball because just the sheer fear of having anything put in my eyes. And I had this, what I consider the My Lab experience, to where I was in a tank of water, and I remember opening my eyes with it, and I could see people standing outside the tank, and I was inside this water with a tube in my mouth. And ever since that experience, I now have no fear of water going in my eyes. It's completely gone. When I'm in the shower, if I get some soap in my eyes, I can open my eyes up in the water and rinse them right out without a single problem. And that I think is very strange, because to overcome something that kind of, you know, phobia or that kind of fear of, you know, with your eyes, like almost instantly, it was definitely says that there was something happened there.
Yeah, like something was altered that fixed it for the better. That's good. Now, in these military experiences, did you get an idea of who they were, what uniforms they wore, where you may have been underground or on the surface?
It seemed like a kind of like scientists a little bit. I can't say, for instance, military or not, but I do have to say that I don't feel that I passed their experience, let's just say that. I feel like that maybe I failed because I haven't had any experiences since then really with them, but I have had that fear that there is going to be something very large on the horizon about to happen and be prepared for. Just kind of like almost like survival training kind of kicks in. I've never had proper survival training, but it feels like I know it, you know, and I could take charge if I had to. Like I've formulated escape routes into a area that I would feel that would be easier to survive in. You know, I have seed banks and everything, and you know, and I'm just waiting, you know, just to see if that happens. It's almost like it's pre-programmed.
Well, that's an interesting point, because many people that have had My Lab experiences have described being trained and tested in their ability to survive in various so-called apocalyptic scenarios, and it varies from like a nuclear environment to civil unrest to two suns in the sky, tsunamis, chemical warfare, etc., etc. And they've actually been trained and tested in things like looting stores, you know, like what are you going to loot when the time comes? You're going to muck around in the cosmetic shop, you know, or you're going to go in there and you're going to grab what you need to grab, right? And so they would teach these people how to survive in such an environment, either singly or in groups, and they would teach people how to, like, delegate responsibility, like how to, okay, you go out, you collect firewood, you go out and you go get drinkable water, and you go out and, you know, you bring back some uncontaminated food. So there's definitely been that element where they feel that sometime down the road, there may be a need for this kind of survival awareness and survivability.
Yes, and I also find myself to be finding careers in, or I should say jobs in certain fields. Like, for instance, my last job, I learned a lot about solar panels and energy banks, you know, so I can wire up solar panels and make my own power grid if I had to now. And right now I work in a distribution center, so, you know, I have full access to, you know, food and waters, which, you know, may be overlooked by most people while everyone's racing to go to the grocery stores to loot or raid. You know, I'd be the opposite. I'd be going towards the distribution centers or whatever, because that's where the big stockpiles are, and they will be virtually untouched.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point.
And office buildings too. You know, they have break rooms. You know, a lot of people bring food and have bottles of, you know, water coolers from water coolers and refrigerators, vending machines. You know, there's so many different places, but you can go in and out without being, you know, mugged or looted or even killed. You know, very simply. You know, I would avoid Walmart at all costs.
Yeah, because what'll happen is, you know, the first couple of days without, you know, lacking the basic utilities, people are gonna, they're going to lose it, basically, and the stores will be immediately looted. So within hours, probably, after any kind of a big event, the shelves in the stores will be empty. There'll be nothing there. And unfortunately, most people in America these days, they don't have that self-sufficiency. They've never had to learn field craft. They've never had to learn how to survive in the woods. They don't know how to tie a fishing lure. You know, simple things mm-hmm. like that, they're just incapable of doing these days.
Now, I will admit, I'm not exactly a rough-it camper. I bring a refrigerator when I go tent camping. But I do know, you know, how to fish, and I know how to work on things. And I've taught myself, thanks to YouTube, has been a huge help for fixing cars. And, you know, if you have to hotwire one or rig something, you can, you know, and it's very, very helpful. And I've also, well, the biggest thing was any survivalist would need, and is the lightest thing to carry is knowledge. And what I do is, you know, I'm a big fan of Natural News and a couple other websites. And what I do is I print off a lot of things on, you know, how to sanitize water or prep a fire or basic survival guides, and laminate them and take them with you, because that's going to be more survival than, you know, carrying a gallon of water with you, because, you know, you can – that's heavy. I mean, you can find water as you go along if you need to.
Yes.
Except for if you're in the desert, of course, it may be a little trickier. But, you know, there are those techniques that, like I said, the lighter the pack you have on your back, the better it is, you know, but you still need your necessities.
Yes, and what I would recommend to the listeners is the SAS Survival Book, written by a former instructor in survival in the British Special Air Service, a guy named Lofty Wiseman. He literally wrote the book on it, and I've got it, and I... One time, years ago, I bought a number of copies and distributed it out to like a lot of my lab friends, because we were going through this kind of training and testing, you know, individually and in a group setting. So I thought, well, you know, we might as well. And they have interesting little tips in there, too. For example, like in a fishing scenario, where if you have access to a certain type of plant and the water in a lake or a pond is such that, you know, there's an area of it that is not fast flowing. He pointed out that if you get this kind of plant, and he showed a diagram of it, a picture of it, and you crush up the leaves and you toss it into the water, the alkaloids or whatever in the leaves will narcotize the fish, and they'll come floating to the surface. You know, it's like, well, I never thought about that, but, you know, and he goes through every kind of survival a scenario in all the different kind of climates and forms of terrain, Arctic, desert, jungle, whatever the case may be. So the listeners out there, the SAS Survival Handbook is a must. Have you ever had dreams where you were being trained or tested, like psychologically or physically, being put through your paces to, you know, like, you know, run or exercise or swim or anything along those lines?
I remember as a kid all the way up to now, I always feel like I'd have dreams every once in a while of being chased by, you know, like a psycho killer or something like that. But you have to run as fast as you can to avoid getting caught. And, you know, as I got older, it kept getting faster. But I'm not a runner by any means. I was more of a cyclist back in the day. But last year, I started running. You know, I started getting on the track, and I was up to about 2 to 3 miles, you know, started running. And it felt like it was a need. It was almost a desire to have to do it, you know, and never understood why, because I would just, you know, walk long distances, you know, 8 to 10 miles a day without a problem, but never run or never jog. But now, and like I said, I've been doing that, and I've just been collecting little odds and ends to kind of help throughout, you know, for survival if needed. But it's funny you mentioned the leaves, though, because I actually did print out this one piece of paper about edible leaves, because, you know, I'm not an arborist in any way. And so I was like, well, if you had to eat something and you had no food available, what kind of plant life could you eat? So I have full pictures of what you can eat and everything. I said that would definitely be good, because there is very many poisonous leaves that would hurt us.
Oh, definitely. And poisonous fungi and poisonous mushrooms, too.
Correct.
Now, have you ever had dreams of apocalyptic scenarios like earthquakes or earth changes or tsunamis or anything along those lines?
Not so much dreams, but I can, for some reason, feel when an earthquake's going to happen. Like when the earthquakes in Haiti and Chile happened, my wife will confirm this, because I look over to her. I'd be sitting in the living room, maybe watching TV or something, and I look over and I say, there's going to be a bad earthquake, like, now. And she looks at me and like, okay. And then the next day she'd read about it. It's like, you know, a magnitude 8.0 hit out here. And she says, how did you do that? I said, I feel it in my gut. I said, I it's like the energy builds up and I can feel the earth shaking. It doesn't happen all the time. Like local quakes, not so much, but like quakes out in California, like big ones, or quakes out in other countries, I can feel it almost instantly. But I almost wonder if that has anything to do with HARP.
Yes.
You know, so I don't know if it's the natural ones I'm feeling or the unnatural ones. I can't tell.
Well, Haiti had, you know, all the hallmarks of an artificially generated event because the so-called relief forces were ready to move in no time flat right after all the problems started there. So it could have been an example when that place was harped or some kind of scalar weaponry or something was utilized to create that disaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did feel the one that hit, the first one who hit Japan. I did feel that one too, and that's just, you know, horrible what's going on. I think that's all done by design to clear out the Pacific Ocean, you know, the wildlife and everything like that. I mean, it's just horrible, you know, that no one seems to be caring that, you know, our seas are being polluted with radiation and that, or no one knows what to do. I have no idea, but either way, it's just not right.
Yeah, like. You mentioned something which I thought was interesting. I'm hearing this more and more of looking at things from a higher dimensional perspective, because you mentioned, you know, before we came on and in some of our communication that, you know, like many of us, you felt like you didn't really belong here, but you're here for some purpose. And we find ourselves in this multiple threat environment where everything is topsy-turvy, where the medicine makes you ill and the food makes you ill and everything is just upside down. And it's easy to get overwhelmed with all this stuff, but what some of us have learned to do is kind of like rise above it in a sense, look at it from a higher dimensional perspective, but still stay grounded and still stay centered. Did you want to talk a bit about that process with you?
Yeah, I felt that all my life. I was born and raised in the Catholic faith up until the sixth grade. I got kicked out of the Catholic faith because I questioned too much. You know, the Bible never made any sense to me. I said there was too many gaps, so I would question it, and then they would tell me to shut up, and then finally they said, get out of here, so they sent me to public school. All I did was question all my life. You know, I said, you know, I said things just didn't make sense that everyone was crammed down their throat and taught, so you have to believe it this way. But even now, as you know, I'm 36 now, and even still, I don't feel like, you know, I can talk to a regular person and feel comfortable. You know, I just don't feel like, you know, I want any traces of myself to be here. You know, I don't have any kids. I really don't want to bring a child into this world at this present moment. And I know that sounds kind of selfish, but when it comes down to it, is I don't want to be here, you know, with all this going on. You know, it's just, you're just a slave, and you're being poisoned left and right, and you feel like you're just being attacked nonstop. And I mentioned to someone the other day, and it's true, I was born in 1981, and I said, I haven't known a single year in my life without war.
Yes.
I said, there's been nothing but war ever since I've been born. And I said, it's just, you know, it's just sad to see that, you know, there's so many opportunities for peace and working together and you know, let the neighbor do what, you know, their own thing and let their neighbor do their own thing, you know, but it's just, you know, I hate to say, you know, we are the bullies in many of these conflicts, and I see that. And like I said, right now I don't feel that I'm meant to be here, you know, I'm other than an observer. You know, I just try, because it didn't seem like that I'm, like I said, I'm not rich, I'm not poor, I'm not smart, I'm not dumb. I'm just kind of always in between. I'm told where to go next. It's like, okay, you're to go to this opportunity next. Learn and try to teach. And that's kind of how I feel.
Well, you've been doing a good job of it thus far, because you found yourself in places where you could learn things. This I found this too. Like I didn't like working for the medical industry because I could see it for what it was all about. I would see the symbiotic relationship between the big pharma and the medical people. It was like very much the case of the tail wagging the dog. And then I find myself in the telecom industry. Though that was actually before. And then, you know, this is when they were rolling out the Iridium satellite phones. And then they were giving a speech to us, and they were telling us, oh, these phones are great. They're really going to be geared up for geologists and explorers and, you know, oil companies. If they're way out in the middle of the ocean or way out in the middle of a desert somewhere, they can always maintain communication, yada, yada, yada. We're going to have a fleet of 66 satellites with 11 in reserve for a total of 77. I'm thinking 66, 77 is a cabalistic number. And we're going to have total blanket coverage of the whole planet. And I'm thinking they can easily piggyback something onto that. You know what I mean? So
that's
the way my mind was working when I'm sitting there. And they're telling us things like, in the future, everyone's just going to have one phone number. No matter where you go, no matter how many phones you switch, no matter how many residences you have. And I'm thinking, well, that's kind of like a personal ID. You know what I mean? So I find myself in these places, and it was like this in the medical community too, because I saw all the evil shit that was going on, pardon my Anunnaki, you know, as far as like clinical trials were concerned and as far as the symbiotic relationship between Big Pharma and the various departments, because I, you know, for a short while I worked in a cardiovascular place, and actually I was interviewing for that. I never got the job, which I'm glad I didn't. And I worked in other different departments where I saw different things, right? And, you know, with my kind of, I wouldn't say conspiratorial mind, but with my kind of curious questioning mind, things began to add up in a different way. All these people around me completely oblivious as to what they're involved in, what they're doing, and I'm seeing things, and, oh, it was adding up all right, you know what I mean? But what I've had to do was I've had to learn to stay grounded and rise above it, because I'm that sensitive type where I'm almost too empathic and I just take on too much on board, and, you know, I start to get this righteous streak of indignation and it starts to like burn a hole through me. And so I've had to learn to, okay, this is not helping me out because it's upsetting me too much. I had to learn to step back, get grounded, and remember, okay, wherever I go, I'm bringing a bubble with me. Wherever I go, I can observe what's going on, but like what you pointed out, we're on this world, but we're not of this world. We're here to observe. We're here to learn. We're here to make a difference in some way, but we're not really from here. We're here on a mission, basically.
Well, I just finished a book called Starseed. I was impulsed to buy it. I was at a local metaphysics shop, and I saw this little book, and I said, let me just go ahead and read it. And it was a very good read, I have to say. Kind of made a little bit of sense to kind of how I felt, you know. It's just, you're of this world, but you're on this world, but you're not of this world, and that's kind of how I felt in a way, and I've always felt. And in being here in the South, you know, because I'm originally from New Jersey, so you had a little bit, lot more open minds. But coming down to the Bible Belt of the South, come to find out that there are awakened people here, but they are very suppressed. They are very scared to come out and say something unless you have an identification of some sort. Like on the back of my truck, I have, you know, two bumper stickers. One is "End the Feds," and the other one is 9/11 was an inside job. And my wife, when she first saw that, she was like, oh, you're going to get vandalized. You're going to get your car keyed. I've actually – quite opposite. I've actually had more people stopping me on the road, asking me questions, giving me thumbs up. I actually even did a 9-hour presentation once at a friend's house just to give them some facts. And it was just, it was really touching, you know, to see that there are awakened individuals, but they have to – it's almost like secret. They have to be very cautious about it. You know, they still have to go to church and still have to believe in what they're taught, but their open-mindedness is they have to be quiet around their parents and loved ones pretty much.
I've noticed that too. I've given speeches in Memphis and in Mississippi, and there is a group of people there, individuals and groups, that are interested and are familiar with this stuff. But by and large, when you're out in society and you listen to the table talk, you know, when you're at the restaurants and at the, you know, at the diners, it's like an entirely different world. And what I've had to learn, I've you know, talked with Kylie about this, my partner, it's like sometimes we almost have to act like we're on a secret mission. And it's okay if people sitting the next table over say all this stuff is nonsense, it's all ridiculous, and only crazy people believe it, because they're on their journey and we're on our own. And it's, you know, like on the surface world, it's like these operatives and these secret agents aren't going to say, oh, no, you're wrong. I know this is true. I'm a secret agent. No one's going to do that. You know what I mean? So it's like we have to learn to just let a lot of that go, because in the overall scheme of things, it really doesn't matter. Well, you know, they're going to find out or they're not going to find out, and they're going to find out in their own way. And we just have to keep doing what we're doing. And it's that bubble I mentioned earlier. Like, everywhere we go, we got our own bubble. We got each other. We know what we're all about. And so we're okay with that. Now, how have you dealt with this, you know, this awakening, now that we're on the subject, as far as your friends and family are concerned? Are some of them open to some of the stuff we've been talking about, especially the ET stuff?
I felt that my relationship with my wife is more like I'm Agent Mulder and she's Agent Scully. that's kind of how it was for quite some time until she started getting – she realizes that I track things. A lot of what she would call ghosts or, you know, sort of negative entities, they follow me sometimes. And, you know, she's experienced quite a lot of it. So she's kind of mellow to it, but she doesn't really ask questions about it. She just goes with the flow with it. I'll tell her about my experiences. She listens, but I don't know how far she'll believe it, or even she doesn't really go into it. I know that I think she does believe now that I do experience these things. She's comfortable with it. But friends, I'm open to friends. See, I'm at the point where I don't care what people think about me. I want true friends in my life. I want true people that say, you know, yes, we have experiences, or if you do have the experiences, we've never experienced it, we still trust you. You know, I'm at the point now where I don't want fake people in my life anymore. Being down here in the South too, like, I'm open to it, but now only if people ask me about it, and I'm only certain that they just want to learn, not just to ask silly questions and just try to, you know, see how crazy you may be, you know.
That
I don't have time for. So, yeah, I have some coworkers who are in their early 20s, and they're conspiracy theorists. You know, I said, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy factualist. I said, I actually make sure I got the facts before, you know, going ahead of anything. I said, but, you know, I don't go and preach it around unless someone actually wants to listen to it. And, I'll turn heads every once in a while because they'll have the Fox News on, if you want to call it that, on the TV, and I'll just start making comments. Like, for instance, the other day we were having a horrible possible threat of a tornado about to hit down here. The news network was on the I-85 north and pouring down rain. They say, oh, it's in whiteout conditions, we can't see. And I look over on the TV screen and they're right behind a 18-wheeler. I said, well, of course you can't see because you got rain water blowing on your windshield from the truck. I said, yeah. You guys are doing that on purpose. And, yeah. And all my coworkers looked over me and just started laughing. They were like, you hit that nail on the head.
Yes, so. It's... You know, perception is reality. It's so much of what we see in this artificial matrix world where there's a parasitical element and then there's the host element that gets parasitically fed on. There's a predator and there's a prey. And the prey does not need to know what's going on. Everything is inverted. Everything is turned upside down. And so, literally, it's to the point now where everything is weaponized, where the educational system is weaponized, where social engineering is weaponized. Like, we were just talking before we came on about that unfortunate poor guy that was pulled off, you know, the United Airlines plane. It's like, you know what? Where are all the social justice warriors screaming racism about that? You know what I mean?
And they managed to pull off a doctor as well, too, which was also very confusing. It's almost like saying, let's punish this one guy with a PhD versus, you know, I'm not saying that he's any better than anyone else, but still, it's like very strange that he was the one that was pinpointed.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, read too deeply into all this, but is there a subtext? Do they want people to see, you know, Asians and Chinese? I think the guy may have been Chinese. I could be wrong. He's South Asian.
Definitely was Asian.
So any Asian at any rate. But, you know, if war with China is on the horizon, is that some kind of subliminal message that they unfortunately had to act out on that poor guy? You know, I mean, they're the ones that overbooked the flight. Why the hell do they have to yank that guy off the plane, right? And
well, the first story I heard about that – oh, sorry to interrupt. The first story I heard about it was that, okay, they said that they were overbooked and they needed volunteers to be removed from the plane, you know, and catch the next flight. And no one rose their hands, and they randomly chose this individual who refused to get off the plane, and they tased him.
They tased him too?
Well, that's why I thought I heard her say that. But,
no, the first stories that came out.
Yeah, because I do remember him being dragged from the plane, you know.
Yes.
Virtually unconscious, and yes. then the second story I hear was, oh, now they had to have room for an employee. I said, well, I didn't hear that on the first story. I said, they said from what I heard on the first story was they overbooked and they needed someone to be removed. So it's what I was telling you before is that the stories are constantly changing. I if you watch one story, 5 minutes later, it's a different story. And then 5 minutes later, a different story. So the problem is even people that are, you know, like I said, conspiratorial factualists, they don't even know, like, you have to, the truth is so mixed up, and I think they're doing it on purpose.
Oh, it is. It's definitely meant to fragment the consciousness and create confusion, because instilling confusion in another is a psychological warfare technique. That's what they do, is instill confusion into people. Like, for example, just to digress for a moment, this whole Syria thing, it's like, you know, what I've been able to piece together, of course I could be wrong, but that area where this incident allegedly took place was rebel-controlled. There was a warehouse there. There was chemical munitions there. The Pentagon had been sending out contractors to work with those rebels, so-called, to deploy and handle chemical weapons. Somewhere along the line, either the Syrian Air Force attacked that warehouse in particular, or it just happened to be one of the places that were hit. And as a result, there was some leakage. And then the powers that be exploited that fact. And also another part of the story is that a number of adults and especially children had been kidnapped by these ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Daesh, white helmet people, whoever the hell they are, kidnapped from areas loyal to the Syrian government. And then those people were killed and their bodies were laid out. And then they spun out the whole thing about the sarin nerve agent. But you could see they're touching these people with their bare hands. The bodies were real enough, sadly. The children were dead enough. That was very sad and unfortunate. But then they try to spin it out and say it was sarin. But anyone who touches someone who's got sarin, like a sarin agent on them, would be dead in seconds. So you knew that was fake. Right, and then the retaliation comes in where they launch all these cruise missiles, but the story goes that the U.S. government had warned the Russians, and the Russians had warned the Syrians, so the Syrians pulled out a lot of their planes and equipment, and only a few like empty buildings had been hit. So it's like, you know, what the hell is going on, you know? And meanwhile, this carrier battle group is steaming towards North Korea, and it just... I think we've officially reached a point where it's like lunatic time on this planet. Well, wouldn't you agree?
Fully. And it's come to the point where I get coworkers who ask me, so have you been following, you know, this story or this story? I said, you know what? No. I said, I'm at the point now where my brain's in overload. I said, yes. It's coming to the point where I need to focus on something else. I said, so I'm going back into my UFO and paranormal studies. I said, because at least that I can make sense to. I said, this is what's happened on this planet. I can't make any sense to, other than, you know, military contractors making billions and billions of dollars and their friends on Wall Street. That's the only answer I can come from all this madness. I said, because other than that, these are just lunatics just wanting to have fun at our expense. I mean, And I have a tendency to think differently than most people. You know, I can think like the bad guy. I'm not going to act like the bad guy, but I can think like the bad guy.
So could I. Yeah, it's a good attribute to have, actually.
Yeah, it is, because you can learn your enemy. And I tell people, I said, look, if you are one of the Rockefellers or whatever, and you got, you know, all the money, quadrillions of dollars, you own the world. I say, after a while, you get bored. I've seen millionaires get bored. I've seen billionaires get bored. I said, so what's the next step? Well, let's go ahead and control the people. Let's go ahead and have some fun. I mean, because after that point, what does it matter? I mean, you already run the world. So, but people don't want to hear that. They're like, oh, you know, they want to think, oh, everyone in the world is good. I'm like, well, not exactly, I said. But it's scary, because you have to think that way in order to understand why this is happening. And a lot of people don't want to believe me when I say that, but it's true. I said, it's, if you think that way, you can make sense to it. But, you know, you're not saying, you know, thinking that way will act, because, you know, for actually many years I studied, for some reason I studied the concept and the theories of Satanism, and I never practiced it. I was just wanted to know about it, and I come to find out it controls 90% of or more of our society today.
Absolutely.
You know, and people were giving me this dirty look, and like, why are you into this stuff? I said, because the knowledge is there. What you can see, what is controlling you on a day-to-day basis, you can counter it, or at least try to, you know, understand it better. And I said, just because you're learning it, and I think there was a saying by someone too, I can't remember who it was, but they said that you can learn it, but you don't have to act on it. There's two different things.
Yeah, I've read books by Crowley. I've read you know, a number of his books actually, and also I've read books about Enochian, the angelic language that was recovered by Dee and by Kelly. Now, I didn't enunciate and pronounce all the invocations. I didn't go that far because you never know what it may summon, but I just kind of skimmed through that part. But yes, because I wanted to know, it's like, you know, what makes these guys tick? Why do they seem to have this body of knowledge and this level of understanding that's not taught in the universities? And why do they seem to believe it so much, and why do they seem to have so much control? That was a key point to me, because the school system and bogus mainstream science rubbishes all that, says it's all nonsense, but in those, like, you know, deep cloistered gentlemen's clubs, this is exactly the kind of crap they do. They get into ceremonial magic, they get into human sacrifice and stuff.
Someone mentioned about that too. It was about the karma. They said that, you know, why is it that they can get away with so much, but, you know, their karma never hits? Well, the theory is that the universe likes, what's it called, unity. And when they're all unified, and they said they do reveal things, but maybe sometimes like 15 minutes on the on a website at 1:30 in the morning when no one's looking, you know. Yes. And they say, well, they did say it, but, and that's all that matters. And we know it doesn't say how long you have to say it for. And, that's, you know, right. And I think that we have a tendency as good people, we make up our own rules that should exist, but don't. And I think that's what happens. I remember when I was beginning my spiritual journey, and there was a very wonderful person who helped me through it. And she kept it very simple. She said, keep it simple. The simpler you keep it, the easier it is to use. And if you start making all these rules and regulations and stuff, it will become extremely difficult. And that is very true.
Absolutely, because in a sense, one would be trying to limit one's full potential, one's ability to fully manifest and express oneself by creating all these artificial inhibitions, which only would really apply to us, wouldn't apply really to the rest of reality. Another thing that's interesting too is the refusal of many to work with the inner shadow, to even regard anything as, that's even halfway negative, rather to disregard anything even halfway negative, whether it's conspiracy fact, whether it's people in the New Cage movement who don't want to hear anything negative, you know, don't want to hear about the reptilians, don't want to hear about this, that. The thing about it is, if some of those people were given the opportunity in these corporations, in these financial institutions, in these intelligence agencies to do whatever they wanted, and the institution in question would have their full backing, some of those people would jump without parachutes to get in on the money. They would get in on anything if it enrich themselves, if it allowed them to get ahead, it gave them more power. And these are some of the very same people who say that, you know, no conspiracies exist. It's only because they haven't had the opportunity. But there are many people in the local councils and the local, you know, supervisorial districts that are just up to their noses in corruption, because they have the means. They can stick their fingers in all these different pies, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, the point I'm making is, like, that's what happens when people don't work on that inner shadow, because there are forces at work that will shunt them into positions of influence and power where they can become corruptible. And those people that say none of this exists, they just haven't been shunted into those like places where they can opportunistically enrich themselves, where they can attain power for themselves, where they can gain a measure of control over others, right? Because some mm-hmm. of these people that are deniers, they're like closet control freaks. They're just waiting for a chance.
Well, what I have discovered throughout my knowledge and throughout this journey is, you know, we are given all these different attributes in our bodies, you know, to feel happiness, sadness, you know, depression, gladness, all that kind of stuff. And when you deny those kind of feelings, you're suppressing them, and they will build up. When I, you know, was looking into the New Age movement before I really realized, you know, what it was and who controls it, and I was seeing all these people that were just, positive, happy people all the time, I said, you're suppressing something. I can tell. And they would look at me and say, well, you can seem to go into the dark side and come out just fine. I said, because I've learned, you know, don't let it control me. And some people that were all the happy-go-lucky people, I've learned to discover that, you know, they had past trauma, you know, very deep, dark trauma. And the only way to forget that trauma was to act happy. But once they released that trauma, their whole psyche changed. I mean, like they were always – for some reason I'm seemed like the vent. Everyone comes to me and vents.
Me too. A lot of people come to me and want to tell me things, you know.
And I'm not talking about, oh, you know, oh, I ran over a dog once or with my car or whatever. No. I'm talking like, you know, kids who were molested, you know, people who were molested as a child and stuff, deep, dark secrets. And I'm like, why me? You know, but when they tell me this stuff, they literally change. Like they're not that new age prisoner anymore. They're back to normal and they realize that, oh man, the spouse I'm with is exactly like the person who suppressed me. And, you know, wind up getting divorced and they wind up finding somebody better. And it's amazing to watch how fast the transformation goes just by getting rid of that little bit of information that's holding you back. And I'm an open book. You know, anyone asks me a question, I will tell you straight up. I mean, I have no problems revealing who I am or what. I have nothing to hide, you know. So, and I think that's why I'm able to, you know, be able to go to the bright side and the dark side so easily without a problem.
Yeah, me too. And it's refreshing to have conversations like this without, you know, flinching, and we can go in different directions as it suits us. Because one thing I've noticed too is a lot of the people that were caught up in their new cage, not only, as you pointed out, do they have this trauma, almost a shared trauma, which is like some program or sub-program that prevents them from delving into anything that smacks of negativity. But when you look at, like you pointed out, their private lives, when you really scrutinize them, some of these people are going through like a living hell. It's like they've got health issues, they've got, you know, marital difficulties, they've got interpersonal relationship issues, they've got problems with their children. And
drugs and alcohol, too.
Drugs and alcohol, because so much, a big part of this, archontic matrix system is self-medication, as you know. And the way that the pharmacopoeia, the psychiatric tyranny, has been set up as a default. Oh, you're happy, you're too happy, you're too sad, you're in grief, you're depressed. Well, we got a pill for that, right? It's very much like a Stepford Wife scenario. So when people can step away from that and they can allow themselves to feel their pain and then move through it and move past it, that's when real healing and real growth develops.
And David Icke pointed out just perfectly. He said, when you look at those ads for medicine on TV, those aren't the side effects, those are the effects. And that's 100% accurate.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see all these artificially happy people. Like, when you look at the ads and the pictures, there's always people. They're caught in the pose of a big smile and a big laugh. And the names they give these drugs, too. Celebrex, because we're celebrating our psychiatric neurosis. You know, we're Effexor, because we're effectively fixing ourselves, right?
It's well, like, I said that there must be a random name generator at some point. I saw one like Lebopso or something like that. I was like, what in the world?
Well, it's probably the same company that comes up with the names that the U.S. military comes up with. Operation Enduring Freedom, you know, it's just, you know, that's almost like an oxymoron or kind of like a double entendre. It's like they're having to endure freedom for a little while until they squelch it all, right? You know, it's kind of like an inside joke. Enduring freedom, right?
But you know, even with the, you know, like, the UFO field and the reptilian field, you know, I'm seeing more and more videos of manifestations happening left and
big
right.
Big time.
And
if it's okay with you, let's go over the first hour a little bit, because we're really on a roll. So please continue.
What I've noticed is that, you know, for years people wanted to catch a UFO on camera. For years people wanted to catch an alien on camera. Now we're catching them on camera and they say, oh, that must be a camera glitch. It's just another excuse after another excuse. I said, the evidence is clear. I mean, the royal family, let alone, is more than enough evidence that anyone needs it. But, you know, the shape-shifting is happening more and more in Hollywood, I've noticed. People are denying it. They're saying, oh, it's not real, but it is real. I was like, you know, I know it's very hard to accept, but even like me, with all the experiences I've had through aliens and UFOs, and I haven't even really touched most of the surface of what I've experienced, I still want them to return. I still, even though the negative ones and the positive ones, I enjoyed the experiences because I was a learning experience. And I've known a lot of people who've dealt with UFOs and aliens and stuff, and they don't want it anymore. They said, we're scared. We don't want it anymore. I'm like, well, aren't you curious as to why you're being chosen? You know, I mean, for me, I definitely want to know why. Why me out of 7 billion people am I so special to have these experiences, or at least be aware of these experiences?
Well, that's how I felt about it, because I want to know everything about everything. And so when I had my awakening, I mean, it took a while for the coin to drop because I had some pretty blatant experiences in 88 and 87 and the early mid-70s. But like I said, you know the people talk about an alarm clock going off. I kept hitting the snooze button, right? But yeah. In the early 90s was when I had my real wake up, because it was so blatant and so in my face, waking up with three reptilian grays, and then, you know, that was a really forgettable experience. And so I was very skittish and frightened for a while, but my natural curiosity and my righteous sense of indignation, I guess, overrid the fear. And so I was able to, the fear was there, it was ever present, but I was able to work through it. And my curiosity was such that I would just go to the bookstores, and this is before Amazon, this is before bookdepository.com, a great place to get books, by the way. It was before all that online, you know, ordering stuff. I just would drive out to, like, you know, the bookstores and clean them all out of alien abduction stuff, right? And then when I realized, my goodness, there's a whole body of literature here, and so much of what they describe is what I've experienced. And we'll delve into your experiences a lot more in the second half. That's okay, David, because yes. what you've touched on in the first hour is excellent, because it underscores the multiple experience type nature of these experiences. It's not all cut and dried medical exams on board of a ship. That's just so cliched nowadays. And it's,
yeah, anal probes and all that stuff doesn't exist.
yeah. And it's like, well, some people go through them, but it's yes. like it's not the be all and the end all. It's like, because right. they mess with us at so many levels, right? Energetically, astrally, physically, et cetera, but. But thank you for sharing all those different things, because that gives the listeners, many of whom have had experiences, confirmation that a lot of the stuff, like I used to think I was being haunted because I was having what I perceived to be, because I didn't have a conceptual framework, I thought I was being haunted because so many of these weird things were going on around me. Objects disappearing, like doors slamming shut behind me, and then the deadbolt sliding over and locking me out of my own bedroom, you know, where I had to actually take the door off the hinges in order to get back in, right? Stuff like that would happen to me on a constant basis, to the point where, even though I was no longer, you know, hadn't been a practicing Catholic since I was a child, never really got into it, but I started leaving a crucifix sitting on the center of a Bible right by my nightstand, because I felt presences around me. I thought I was being haunted, David.
Yeah, yes. I know, and I was the same way. You know, I didn't really have too many of the negative experiences in the paranormal when I was younger, but I did have some very odd and unusual ones, even levitation. I was the weird one, I remember I was playing basketball one time with some friends, and I swear, I mean, I'm a three-point shot. I can't, you know, just sink a basket to save my life. But I remember playing and almost like walking on air, and almost like as if there was invisible steps there.
Yes,
and
I could
feel things. Yeah, and then one time I was riding my bike and I did something stupid, and I was cutting through a Wendy's parking lot and through the drive-thru, and I didn't see this car was heading right for me, and I swear I hit my brakes on my bike, and my back of my bike went flying in the air, and I literally got pulled off my bike almost like by the back of my pants, laid perfectly on the ground without a problem, and then the bike just crashed on the ground with full force. And I looked at that when that happened, and I said, my legs should have gotten caught on the handlebars. I said, but it didn't. I said, I was lifted right off. And this woman's face that I rode out in front of, it just looked at me with, like, dumbfounded. She was like, I can't believe what I just witnessed.
Oh, those things happen. Like, for example, I was a passenger in my sister when she first started driving, right? She was driving this little Chevrolet Arrow. And and that's a whole nother Mandela effect. People are saying that the spelling of Chevrolet changed, you know. And anyway, I was sitting in the passenger seat, and it looked to me like she was going to get into a collision, you know. So I instinctively stomped down with my left foot, like kind of in a braking motion, and it made the whole car spin around, right?
Yes.
And she goes, what the hell happened? I go, I don't know. It's just like Greg Braden talks about this with the Divine Matrix, where when we apply emotion to a particular thought or intention, it kind of powers the intention, and it manifests a change or effect in the Divine Matrix. And that seemed to have happened, right, on that occasion.
Well, I've had experiences that were just, you know, too much to be a coincidence. Like, for instance, I was about to leave work one day, and the car wouldn't start. You know, it would crank, but it just wouldn't turn over. And finally it turned over, and I go up to the corner in Atlanta, and I look, and if I happened to have the car start that 3 seconds ago, I would have gotten hit in a head-on collision because the car ran a red light. And I would have been right in that intersection at that given moment because it was 3 seconds prior to, and I missed it. Yes. And you know, it's things like, and he was going very fast, so I knew that it wasn't a simple matter where you can slam on the brake. So I know that there is some force that is looking out for me in many ways. You know, whether you call it a guardian angel or any kind of force, but I don't really care because this is actually good to know that someone's there.
Exactly. You know, because the system would have us believe we're just body bags, we're just like blood bags that were, you know. Now they're saying, oh, you humans are so worthless. Why don't you merge with machines? Which that process, unfortunately, for some, is well underway. Why don't you merge with machines to like improve yourself? But you know, we're connected to organic source, and so we're already as great. Well, we're gonna become more greater than we are now. We're just in a process of remembering, and we're stripping away the amnesia. Like when you talked about the you know, the basketball thing, I remember when I was like in grade school, second, third grade in Daly City, California. We used to play kickball, and instead of like throwing the ball from base to base, kind of like softball or baseball, to get the outs, we would just drill the base runners with the with the kickball. You know what I mean?
Right.
And for some reason, I had this ability, and I was a little kid. They called me shrimp, all these unkind things, because I was a little guy, right? And for some reason, when someone would throw that ball at me, and you know, there was an understanding. You don't drill somebody in the face, right? So you went for their body. But I had this way, and I still remember it clearly to this day, where things would slow down, and I would like elevate and like almost do like a Pete Townsend scissors kick kind of thing, where I would just jump up in the air and seemingly in slow motion, feeling like I was being elevated, and the ball would pass through my legs, and then zap, I'd be back in real time running to the next base, right? And then I did that over and over. People were confounded. They couldn't drill me with a ball because I'd always hop over it, right?
Yeah.
And then oftentimes I'd do it in this slow motion, weird fashion where everything around me would slow down. And then also, you know, I was like, we would play pickup games. This is when we used to have real long recesses back in the day.
We were actually able to get the sugar out of your system and then the energy so you weren't ADD.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they would actually let you play out there for a while and be a kid. And I remember playing this pickup game of football during lunch, and someone threw the ball. It was too high, and it was like I elevated like in slow motion, and I elevated really high. And remember, I was a really small kid, and I caught it right in my chest, and then I landed, and then, you know, time sped up again, and then, you know, but then people talk to me afterwards. It's like, you know, how did you do that? How did you catch the ball earlier? It's like, I don't know. Because back then, there were no inhibitions. There were no limitations we placed on ourselves. You know what I mean?
Correct.
So it was like, well, I'm just going up to catch this ball. That's all I was doing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so things like that have happened to us. It's kept us out of like really bad accidents, like you pointed out. And it all goes to show, folks, that we do have air cover, if you will. There are supporters and benefactors and friends and guides at various levels in the higher spiritual realms, and they are there to watch over us and protect us. And I know I made, you know, my guardian angels kind of scratch their head a time or two and shake their head wondering, it's like, you know, why did I get this assignment, right? I've never taken it for granted. I've always appreciated having them around. Well, we've reached the end of the first hour of a very interesting discussion with my friend David Wargon. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you believe in what we do, if you like what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up, and become a member, and we'll be with you at the top of the next hour.